Okay, folks, I can neither confirm nor deny the rumors of Kermit the Frog's new girlfriend, Denise. But I can tell you that here on This Week in Law, this week, we are bringing you Law in Space. We've got two very great experts in the burgeoning field of space law with us here today, Professor Henry Hertzfeld and Nathan Johnson. We're going to discuss many a thing, including space, fire, water, space IP, space money, space wars, and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson. Episode 319, recorded September 11, 2015. Dude dinged my Death Star. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Braintree. If you're working on a mobile app and searching for a simple payment solution, check out Braintree. With one simple integration, you can offer your customers every way to pay, period. To learn more and for your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/twill. And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/twill. Hello, folks. Greetings and salutations from planet Earth. I am Denise Howell, and this is This Week in Law. And I am so excited about this particular episode of This Week in Law that you're joining us for, because it is our first ever all space, all the time panel. We're going to talk about space law today, and we have an amazing group of folks to do so with. Joining us is Henry Hertzfeld. He is a research professor of space policy and international affairs at George Washington University and a member of the Space Policy Institute at the Elliott School of International Affairs. Hello, Henry.
Morning for you. It's afternoon for me. Yeah.
Morning for us. And yeah. Goodness knows, you know, suborbitally what sort of time frames we're talking about. Anything might go today. Also joining us is someone who's well acquainted with Henry. Nathan Johnson is the founder of the Space Law Society at George Washington University Law School. He was research assistant to Professor Hertzfeld. He also, very interestingly, I thought, interned with the FAA Office of Commercial Space Transportation during SpaceX's first licensed flights to the International Space Station. He's also the author of a great space law newsletter called Astro-ESQ, E-S-Q, short for Esquire. Welcome to the show, Nathan.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you on. Curious about your internship at the FAA. You were there for the first licensed flights of SpaceX to the International Space Station. Were there unlicensed flights?
No, but there were licensed test flights that would get into orbit. But that was the first time when I was there that they actually approached and berthed with the International Space Station. So it was a milestone for them. It was a milestone for the office. And it was really fun to be in an office where it looked like all the work stopped and everybody was just glued to their computer monitors watching it online. Mm-hmm. But that was actually part of their job, was to monitor the actual mission. So it was fun to be in an office where that was your job, was to watch.
All right. And of course, back from a short hiatus is our co-host, Sarah Pearson. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Denise. I'm really excited about the show today. I'm going to learn so much.
I am too. So exciting. I've even brought, the people see this and ask about it all the time in the background. It sits in my office. My old Estes rocket from younger days that's going to participate in our show today simply as a passive bystander, I hope. Let's get into it. So many interesting things to discuss. We talk a lot, as folks who listen to and watch the show frequently know, about intellectual property on this show. So I thought we'd talk about IP in space. And since we're doing space travel, we may as well do time travel as well a bit and take us back to the summer of 2013 when Commander Chris Hadfield on the International Space Station did a video, a cover of a very well-known David Bowie song that I believe we're going to play for you right now.
To Major Tom, you've really made the grade, and the papers want to know whose shirts you wear, but it's time to guide the capsule if you dare. This is
All right. So we definitely noticed this when it happened back in 2013, talked about it on the show back then, played other clips from it back then. There was a wonderful Economist article that went deep on all the IP ramifications of Commander Hadfield covering Major Tom from the International Space Station. And it is, I think it was in our discussion notes back then. It's in them again today. You can find them at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. I really encourage you to read the whole article because this particular IP use wound up not being as controversial as it could have been because Commander Hadfield and his people worked closely with David Bowie and any other rights holders that were involved and got permission to do this, cleared everything in advance rather than just deciding to cut a cover from the space station. But had he done so and had he broadcast live the had he not gotten all the permissions and had he broadcast live, the IP situation could have been very different. So I thought this would be a great way to kick off our show and ask Professor Hertzfeld what he thought about this when it happened and whether this delighted you and gave you some good fodder for your class.
IP is important, of course, but not the major thing we talk about in class. It's a separate topic. And, the astronauts, many of them are, of course, very talented and do a wonderful, their own personalities come through in space. But in terms of intellectual property, there isn't an awful lot of controversy. He was on the space station. There are two things. There's a space station agreement among the partners, the 14 nations, and a lot of these issues are fleshed out in that partnership agreement. And there's also a crew code of conduct, and there's also a relationship that's spelled out between the commander and the ground, so that there shouldn't be too many surprises. Intellectual property essentially is similar in space to what it is on Earth, because each of the modules in space is owned and controlled and under the jurisdiction of different nations. And the basic idea for in the law of space, particularly on the space station, is that where you are, that nation's laws apply to the part of the space station that you happen to be in at the time. So if he was in the European part of the space station, the Columbus module, he would follow the European codes. If he's in the United States part, he would follow ours, and similarly for the Russian or Japan and so on.
All right, Sarah, what about, this was not a live broadcast, but let's take the example of live broadcasts from space and try and wrap our copyright brains around them. In this Economist piece, they quote J.A.L. Sterling, a London-based expert on international copyright law, who wrote a 2008 paper called Space Copyright Law, The New Dimension, where he listed dozens of potentially problematic scenarios that could arise He asked what would have happened if on a moon landing broadcast live by NASA across the world, two astronauts were overcome by emotion and burst into song, one covered by copyright. He posits that NASA might still be engaged in litigation 40 years later. And then another example Sterling came up with was considering space travelers who put copyrighted material from Earth on a server reachable from space, or who might engage in rights-violating public performances for crewmates. And here's a quote from the piece. If the first person to walk on Mars decides to launch into a whole new world, the rights will need to have been cleared with Disney first. What do you think about all that?
Well, music copyright is the one area where I just, it's always jumbled in my head, so I have to look things up. But I remember, I did notice in the article, it talked about how the compulsory licensing rights for cover songs doesn't include the right to broadcast. So it technically wouldn't fall under a compulsory license. I didn't actually look that up to double check to make sure. I don't know if you know off the top of your head, but
off the top of my head, no. I think all this is fascinating, and maybe I'll kick that back to Professor Hertzfeld and see if he has a thought on it.
Not a particular, this is not my expertise, my area of expertise. And, but I, again, we can dream up all sorts of scenarios. And I am sure that for 95% of them, maybe more, we can find terrestrial examples that might be similar and that have been litigated and where there are decisions and we can follow them. I mean, areas where there's no sovereignty, sometimes in the if you're out at sea and not on a ship, it's hard to imagine. But Antarctica, you know, some of these things may have happened. And even the explorers going to the North Pole, perhaps. So that I don't think this is going to be the serious problem in space as we move ahead. And I think it can be dealt with fairly well.
All right, good. Nathan, any thoughts on copyright before we move on to a couple of other IP issues?
You know, I think this is one of the issues in early space law where it's what's the scale of the problem? How many people do we actually have in outer space who could be these potential lawbreakers? And right now, all the astronauts on the International Space Station are very highly trained, are all professionals. Obviously, astronaut Hadfield, you know, did his due diligence, didn't do this without, you know, notifying ground control. So right now, like Professor Hertzfeld said, this isn't really a near-term problem, but we are starting to look at what will happen when we have less trained or less professional people going into outer space, space tourists who will still go through sort of like physical training so they can withstand flying into outer space. But like you said, who may become overcome with emotion when they are, you know, circling the globe for the very first time. Burst into song, maybe they're broadcasting it live down to Earth. If they're on a Virgin Galactic flight, doing it on Virgin's internet satellite service. One of the issues that does come up, though, especially with Virgin Galactic as an example, is the idea of a space tourist going into orbit and then looking down back at Earth and taking a photograph. And that may seem innocent enough, just like singing a song to yourself, or if you're being live broadcast, singing a song out of happiness. But there are certain regulations about taking, you know, remote sensing images of the Earth. And again, this is something that is coming up more as we talk about the emergence of space tourism, having these sort of untrained professionals who are just doing something they think is innocent enough, but may in fact run afoul of certain laws on Earth.
Let me add to say that there is an exception for handheld cameras at the moment. And astronauts have been up in the space. They have sometimes have their own cameras and they've taken pictures. And that's been deemed not to need a license. In this case, for remote sensing Earth observations, the licensing agency is not the FAA, but it's NOAA, part of the Department of Commerce. And what is interesting as we move ahead, though, are these small satellites that may be no bigger than a handheld camera. And they may be put into space in swarms. There's a company called Planet Labs that's started to do this. And they do need licenses. So that there are some differences between I like to call people going into space adventurers, not tourists. But if we have private passengers going there, excuse me, this issue could come up again, but I doubt that they would have cameras of enough resolution and fidelity to make any difference. And parenthetically, the United States very recently just removed the resolution requirements on even the most sophisticated imagers in space. So that I don't think that will be a serious problem.
And I know that when I get to do space adventuring, the first thing I am doing is getting as high a resolution camera as I can with me and taking as many pictures as possible and posting them everywhere I conceivably can. And I assume I'm not alone in that desire. What were you going to say, Sarah?
Oh, I was just going to ask what the rationale was behind the licensing scheme there. Is it a matter of safety because they're trying to target like satellite type of imaging, or is there some other, what's the rationale for having restrictions about that?
Oh, well, it's shutter control, it's defense, it's security, and it is basically imaging of the Earth that is of concern at the moment. We haven't dealt very well yet with taking pictures of other satellites or of, taking pictures out the stars or whatever from space. So that you can easily envision how that can and will be an issue as we move ahead. For example, if you take a picture of another nation's satellite, you may be able to figure out a lot of things that it's doing, or even the idea of satellite servicing, which is part of it's going up, taking pictures of a satellite to see what went wrong, why the solar panels didn't expand, or whatever might have happened if there was a bit of a hitch in the launching of a satellite.
Okay.
All right. So pictures from space of the Earth are a developing area of law, depending on subject matter and the degree of resolution, et cetera. That'll be an interesting area to watch. The United States has enacted a law that deals with inventions in space, things that are – here, let me pull it up so I can give you the exact language – things that are made, used, or sold in outer space on a space object or component thereof or under the jurisdictional control of the United States. Anything that falls under that rubric is deemed to be made, used, or sold within the United States for this purpose. I just thought this was interesting that Congress was looking ahead to inventions in space, wondering if other countries have done so too, and if we're looking at intra-country arguments about who owns what IP that happened to have been developed in space. Nathan, do you know anything about this?
Well, the International Space Station is an agreement among, few specific nations. And that ISS agreement isn't necessarily a treaty, but it has the enforceability of a contract between those nations. And so by definition of their agreement on the ISS, they sort of apportioned, all right, certain countries have certain modules, and the easiest way to do this is just say your country's law applies in your module. And this was great when we're talking about the government-run operations. But, of course, looking ahead, we want to start allowing private use of certain facilities, private testing, experimentation, sort of turning over portions of the ISS to a non-government entity to allow full utilization of those services. And so I think it's there in the move to privatize, not the whole station, but to allow private experimentation that the Congress wanted to step in and provide some backbone to those private companies there on the station, but also looking ahead to private modules. Bigelow Aerospace is a premier company that's looking to build sort of inflatable space habitats. And if it's a low enough cost, you can foresee private companies coming together and maybe time-sharing, renting out space on a private space station, and they too would want some sort of backbone and enforceability to protect their inventions while they're up there.
Right. Henry, can I ask you, one of the things that sort of makes me scratch my head about this statute is the fact that Congress decided to use language that says made, used, or sold, not just made or created or conceived.
The main purpose of that law was not space station, but it was if you wanted to go up, manufacture something in space, even on a free flyer, and bring it back, it wouldn't be treated as though it were an export and taxed with tariffs or duties. So if it was a United States launch and company's operations in space, then you I'll step back in a minute and explain why. But it's treated as though it were a U.S. Something manufactured on land in the United States, and it was really a taxing and export and tariff issue. The space station, its agreement's a slightly different thing, and we're talking there maybe more with inventions and intellectual property. This could be manufacturing anything, even drugs in space. You bring them back, you're not going to be taxed as though it's an import. Anything that is launched from a country, the launching state, that nation is responsible forever, actually, as long as that object is in space. And as such, it is treated as it is though it was owned by either the government of that country, if it were a government launch, or a private company in that from that launching state. And that's the idea here, that something sent into space where you had a manufacturing facility, maybe that will happen in the future. It's been proposed. People have had ideas to do it in the past that haven't really worked out very well. But the idea is it's as though it were manufactured next door and in the country.
All right. Yeah. I think that IP in space is a fascinating topic, but as our guests have pointed out, probably not as fascinating as all of the rest of the things we could be discussing. So we're going to move on in a moment and get to ideas like ownership and who makes big planetary scale decisions, liability, jurisdiction, security, etc. And more. I think we'll talk right after our break here about the law of the ISS that we've touched on a bit to give people an idea of how that works. But before we get to all that, we're going to thank our first sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Braintree. Braintree is code for easy online payments. Of course, whether you're in space or right here on planet Earth, you've got to get paid for your services. If you're a mobile app developer, you really have to check out Braintree. Braintree is the payment solution used by companies like Uber, Airbnb, Hotel Tonight, Living Social, and Muntry. You've heard of all of those. And Braintree scaled with these companies from early stage startups to the successful companies they are today. So Braintree can scale with your business too. Braintree has made the payment experiences in these apps seamless and magical. And now you can add a similar experience to your own app. With excellent customer service and simple integration, Braintree gets you ready to receive payments quickly. And Braintree's continuous support plus fast payouts means you'll be prepared as your company grows from your first dollar to your billionth. Braintree is helping solve the problem of mobile cart abandonment by offering a best-in-class mobile checkout experience. You got to check it out for yourself. The way you're going to do that is go to braintreepayments.com/twill. Where you're going to find a full stack payment solution, support for all payment types for your customers. You can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, Bitcoin, Venmo cards, and more, all with a single integration across all platforms. with superior fraud protection, customer service, and fast payouts. So when you go to BraintreePayments.com/Twill, you're going to get a really amazing deal. You're going to get your first $50,000 in transactions fee-free. No fees at all. You're going to collect $50,000 through Braintree without a single payment to them. So go check it out at BraintreePayments.com/Twill. Thank you so much, Braintree, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's dig into some space law and policy issues. All right, gentlemen, bring us up to speed on the ISS. Henry, you began to tell us how it's basically an aggregation of floating countries up there. It's various modules. Can you give us the nutshell version of how law operates on the ISS and the interesting high points, if any?
Well, as I mentioned before, there's a lengthy set of agreements, and they've evolved. I mean, the space station is now that agreement's what, 20 years old. Mid-90s was when it was first started, and it's been changed as situations have changed over time. But it basically, as I said, has a couple parts to it. The agreement among the nations, there's a fund about funding and contributions. And then the code of conduct for the crew and, again, the commander in the ground station. But the structure is that each nation that's involved is part of that agreement. And in space law, there's something called the Registration Convention, which has been signed by quite a number of nations, not everyone. But and it basically says that if a nation launches something into space, it's supposed to let the world, through the United Nations, know that some of the details about what it launches, its orbits and its means of getting up there and things of that sort. But it also has some provisions for that nations must retain jurisdiction and control over the objects that they've launched into space. And the Registration Convention is a mechanism that the partners in the space station have all agreed to be part of. And that's how, when they register those modules, you determine whose law applies. And because the United States is, of course, the lead in the space station development and construction, and the power units and other common utilities, so to speak, in the station are mainly put there through the United States. If somebody doesn't obey the law or there's an issue, and it's not dealt with by the law of a particular country's module where the issue might occur, then there are some march-in rights that the U.S. has in order to maintain the operations and the safety and so on of the station.
Nathan, I'm curious, given the way the legal structure of the ISS works, are certain things legal in parts of the ISS that might not be permissible in others based on the different planetary or the different countries' laws that apply?
I am not too sure about a comparative analysis of illegal activities on the space station. But again, these are all very high level competent agencies that entered into this agreement. They all have scientific and they all have scientific goals while they're up there. So I'm pretty sure the agreements all cover the same things. Just, again, it's the differences for the domestic law of those countries that would apply. But again, while they're up in space, all those countries, are still beholden to the Outer Space Treaties and their general conduct. So I think everybody up there is pretty much on the level. I don't think you could get away with something on one module and not another.
Right. And I guess we should maybe explore some of those outer space treaties, some of which in our whole approach towards space law date back quite far, 40 or 50 or even 60 years to when Russia and the United States were the only two players in the field. And I remember reading in one of our discussion background pieces for the show today about the decision, the property decision, you know, how are we going to decide who owns what in space, basically? You know, are we going to treat it as a high seas situation, the law of the high seas here planetarily on the Earth? Are we going to perhaps have an arrangement, you know, a flyover kind of arrangement where the property on Earth extends upward a certain amount of space that includes orbit? Can you speak to that for us and how things worked out on that front, Henry?
Sure. Like any treaty, the words are what's in there is a compromise. There are basic concepts and rules. There are exceptions. There are ongoing controversies, particularly as we move ahead into more commercial space. But essentially, as you said, it was the United States and the Soviet Union then were the two countries that could access space. No other nation had launch vehicles capable of going above the atmosphere. And one of the first issues that's really never been solved is, where does space begin? There's a committee in the United Nations, a Committee on Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, COPUS. And that's where these issues get debated. And that's where the treaties were originally written before they were ratified by member nations. 50 years later, they are still discussing where the atmosphere ends and where space begins. We all know the range. It's somewhere between 90 and 110 or so kilometers up there. It's about 62 miles or so. But the exact border has never been defined in a treaty or really by any nations. So we start there. Where does it all begin? And of course, if it's below in the atmosphere, then as you described correctly, anything above a nation is controlled and owned by that nation to use as it sees, and its laws apply. And different nations, of course, have different laws. So that's one problem. And it's not been a serious problem. It's one reason why it hasn't been solved, because we haven't had an accident in that gray area at the edge of space. Mm. There have been some countries way back in the 70s along the equator when other nations were putting up the geosynchronous satellites, telecom and others, that sort of stay above the same place on the Earth as the Earth rotates. And it's called the Bogota Declaration, and they filed it with the International Telecommunications Union, I believe it was in 1976. Nations along the equator simply said, hey, that's ours. There's never been a resolution of that filing. It's just sat there. And in the treaties, anything in outer space is not subject to sovereignty. Space itself is a place where no government can, by Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty, appropriate a celestial body, an orbit, or anything like that in space. So that that's the basic idea, that there's no sovereignty there. We have that in the law of the seas, but there are some, it's not the same. It's similar, just as it's similar to the Antarctica Treaty of 1958, which declared Antarctica to be a zone of no sovereignty. That doesn't mean you can't go and sit there or put a research facility up, and that would belong to you, but the land does not. And same idea in space. As I mentioned, if you launch a satellite or a rocket, it's in space, it's your property. But the space itself is not subject to the sovereignty of any government.
All right. Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Finish your thought.
No. I'll wait for another question. Go ahead.
Okay. So we got a good question from IRC that I'm going to go ahead and co-opt not only as our next question, but as our first MCLE passphrase for the show. We put these phrases into the show at random points so that if lawyers or other professionals who need professional education credit are watching the show and submitting their activity for credit, they can prove that they actually watched or listened to the show. So our first one is going to be Space Court. And my question to Professor Hertzfeld and to Nathan as a follow-up is there a Space Court? Does the Committee for Peaceful Use of Outer Space have any sort of dispute resolution arm, or does anyone else?
Simple answer is no.
No.
All of the treaties call upon diplomatic negotiations as the first level of dispute resolution because the treaties apply to governments, not to the companies, not to individuals. The Liability Convention, which is another one of the treaties, does have a procedure for a claims commission to be formed. It's like arbitration, but it's voluntary. It has to be agreed to by both sides. And it has never in the 50 years or so of the treaties been invoked. Not that we haven't had disputes, but we haven't used that mechanism. There is an international court of justice located in The Hague that generally handles transborder disputes, and it would be possible in the future to bring a case in front of the International Court of Justice, but a space law case itself has never been brought to, in front of them. And just a note, a company or an individual cannot bring a case there. It would have to be the government versus another government acting on behalf of its citizens in a dispute before the ICJ. So that the UN COPUS is a place to talk, to draft treaties. It has no enforcement mechanism at all built in. If there were a serious space problem, it would probably have to be brought before the Security Council of the United Nations and dealt with like any other international incident. Underneath that, if you have a dispute between two U.S. companies, for example, or two companies from any country, national jurisdiction, national courts in those countries could be the mechanism for solving a dispute between countries. And we have plenty of those, and also arbitration, written into satellite contracts and other types, even in intellectual property patent cases, can be handled domestically if both parties are from the same country.
Right. As an aside, I have to just confess that while listening to your answer there, Professor Hertzfeld, and hearing you describe the International Court in The Hague is the place for trans-border disputes. I actually heard for a second transporter disputes, so I'm glad that we've got that cleared up. Nathan, do you think that there is a need for a space-specific court, or if the various mechanisms we have in place that Professor Hertzfeld described are sufficient?
Again, I think this is a problem of scale right now. Like Professor Hertzfeld said, if there were a really large accident that would actually be worth going after, an award for, that usually would rise to sort of like an international incident, in which case we would want to rely on, diplomatic relations between two different countries to settle that. They could settle it themselves. They could go into arbitration, like Professor Hertzfeldt suggested. The Permanent Court of Arbitration a few years ago actually published what they called optional rules for arbitration of disputes relating to outer space activities. So there are, some guidelines out there for people who would want to agree to settle it that way to follow. Like Professor Hertzfeldt said, they could go to the ICJ. So right now, sense of scale, there's no need for a permanent standing court. But I will say the International Institute of Space Law actually has an annual moot court competition. So law students from North America and regions elsewhere in the world every year have a sort of hypothetical situation. And the way it's written is that two different countries have brought this case before the ICJ. And so every year we have, I don't actually know the number of teams, but almost 100 teams across the world every year practice what it would be like to argue this sort of case before the ICJ. And in fact, the world finals of this competition every year are judged by three actual ICJ judges. So we have training for law students and young lawyers about what this would look like in the future. And then we also have participation from ICJ judges, almost training them as well to what it would be like if they had to sit and decide a case like this.
That is really, really cool to learn. Sarah, do you have any questions about anything we've been talking about so far before we move on into some other topics?
Well, the thing I was going to ask is just kind of how far into the future is that scaling when, commercial, because you hear a lot in the news about potential commercial ventures into space, but I don't really have a good sense for how imminent that is. I mean, is that still so far in the future that we're not really seriously considering how we're going to handle it, or is it imminent?
Depends how you define commercial. The most of the things in space, most of the proposals, most of the activity, even if it's done by a private firm, are dual use. They have government and maybe even security uses, as well as possible private sales. So that we're still in another world of moving toward private companies with ideas and with things they might be able to do and sell directly to consumers beyond telecommunications and beaming photons or whatever electrons back to Earth. So that I can see it happening. But in terms of true commercial operations in space, I think it's a ways off. And almost everything, as I said, will fit either a science or research government mission and be useful to governments as well as to these companies. So that I think the newspapers in some ways have given a public perception of more there than there really is. And I also believe that most of these private companies would not see the profitable opportunities that they are talking about if they didn't also have a government or several governments, doesn't have to be the United States government, as a potential customer along with other customers. So that we're seeing a change, but it's a trend. But I don't think it's going to be anything that's going to be super big overnight. It's going to take time.
All right. I want to point people toward a wonderful article for which Professor Hertzfeldt was interviewed in Gizmodo. It's called A Space Lawyer Explains How We'll Forge a Civil Society Off Earth. And there are a lot of good points and issues raised there. And the author concludes with, astronauts get all the glory, but the earthbound lawyers who happen to specialize in space deserve just as much credit. So I'm happy that we have two such folks on the show with us today, helping us grapple with these fascinating issues. And one of the most fascinating and troublesome issues I can think of regarding policy for space is how we make decisions, how we work together as a planet to make decisions on a planetary scale for things that do not involve planet Earth. And to cue up, you know, what kinds of decisions I'm talking about, Elon Musk was interviewed on The Late Show by Stephen Colbert a couple of nights ago. I just wanted to play you a clip of that interview.
You'd warm it up. Just warm it up.
If you with a blanket or with what? How would you warm Mars up? You know, it's a long way away from the sun.
It's the fast way and the slow way.
Okay. Give me the fast way.
The fast way is drop thermonuclear weapons over the poles.
You're a super villain. That's what a super villain does.
Yeah.
So, Professor Hertzfeld, who gets to make decisions about warming up Mars, whether it happens, how it's done? Is it an individual like Elon Musk, or how does you see this all playing out?
Oh, I don't see it playing out at all for a while. Unfortunately. But just from a strictly legal perspective and putting it in the context of the treaties and nothing much more than that for the moment. As I mentioned, governments are responsible for their actions and for the actions of non-governmental entities, meaning companies, individuals in space. Article 6, the Outer Space Treaty, lays that out, and nations have also included in that responsibility are supposed to continuously supervise the activities of their own governments and of their citizens, companies, too, in space.
All right, Nathan, any further thoughts on dropping bombs on Mars's poles?
On Mars, you would need to get a license or an agreement from our government if it were a U.S. launch. And I don't think that...
I think we've got some freezing going on there.
Yes. Sorry about that. We'll come back to Professor Hertzfeld in a moment. Anything you can add?
Wait a minute. Okay. Are we back?
There, you're back. Yes, we're having a few Skype glitches with your connection. We haven't gotten permission from the government adequate to continue
I don't know
on.
Who's
clearly,
outside here. We're halfway between the White House and the State Department. Who knows?
Yeah.
So anyway, there's also an Article 9 of the Outer Space Treaty. It's a little weak in its language, but it does talk about nations not doing harm to the plans of other nations and for prior consultations. And certainly, if you were to try to do something as radical as what Mr. Musk had talked about on that show, it would potentially do a tremendous amount of environmental harm in space, and I seriously doubt that any responsible nation would let anybody do something like that. So there are some mechanisms for controlling that, but it's...
I think Professor Hertzfeld has frozen again. We'll get back to him in just a moment. Nathan, on this subject, there's a great piece in... The Independent UK called Who Owns Outer Space and What Happens When Corporations Want to Extract Resources from Asteroids or Planets. We've got that in the discussion points today. And it concludes by talking about an organization called Planetary Resources, which exists to explore mining opportunities robotic mining opportunities on asteroids. One of their advisors, we can only, you know, be grateful, is director James Cameron, who did the Avatar film, which was all about, you know, not going to foreign planets and treating them as though they're our own and not anybody else's. So do you have any thoughts on how these kinds of major future type decisions will be made?
It's something that people start talking about right now. It's been talked about because people like to dream about being asteroid miners. Peter Diamandis, Planetary Resources, I think, specifically said he grew up dreaming of being an asteroid miner, as odd as that may be. But again, we have actual businesses being formed. And one of the things about businesses is that they like to plan with some certainty. So when they bring up a hypothetical, they're actually putting money behind it. So it becomes a little bit more real because they want to be able to raise more money and actually achieve this hypothesis. So nobody is mining yet. Planetary Resources has not even chosen an asteroid to mine yet. They have not built a robotic miner. If anything, they have drawn up plans for satellites to identify asteroids they would want to mine. So to start off with, that's how far away we are from having an actual case before us. But the discussion around it, it talks about, first, the Outer Space Treaty says no national appropriation of outer space. So we can't have anybody stake a claim. Well, we can't have a country stake a claim to an asteroid. Okay, that's fine. People want to say, well, then a private company is not a country. Could a private company stake a claim to an asteroid? And the answer to that is we don't know. Some of the leading international law term is publicists. Some of the leading publicists say the treaties are silent on whether a private company can get around this loophole. Other people say private companies who just want to mine resources would not actually be appropriating the whole asteroid. They would just be taking, let's say, mineral rights from the asteroid. You know, my property professor described property as a bundle of sticks. So instead of having a private company try to claim a whole asteroid, they'd just be taking one stick out of the bundle and trying to bring those resources either back down to Earth or use those resources in space. It's a question that's being brought up now, again, because businesses want some certainty in order to invest and plan ahead. And it's these sort of questions that are being brought up in places like the UN COPUS, so that multiple countries can try to talk about it. On the other hand, we have the US Congress, which proposed the Asteroids Act, which wasn't intended to establish brand new international law. The only thing the Congressional Act meant to do was say, if a US company wants to have, you know, mining rights that are enforceable against another US company, then in the U.S., we will recognize that. So we have some small steps that we're trying to take domestically. We have international conversations that are going on. But it's the last thing to say about it. I had a law professor who, you know, cautioned against trying to form early law. Trying to form the law before the incident that requires it can sometimes lead to a messier conclusion. So it's one of those things where chicken or the egg, are we going to see an actual case of mining first before we see the law that will establish it? Or do these businesses really want the international community to write the law first so that they can go and do it under that certainty?
Right. It just seems like such a human nature thing. I definitely agree we shouldn't be trying to formulate laws before there's an actual need for them, that's a dangerous thing to do. But of course, you know, the first thing that people did when they actually set foot on the moon was plant a flag and act very proprietary about what they were doing up there. Professor Hertzfeld, do you think that the treaties that we have in place now are equipped to accommodate private space exploration and corporate mining interests?
The treaties were not written specifically with that in mind. And we are going to have to, I think, expand some of our interpretations of some of the meanings of the words of the treaties to accommodate business. That's not going to be easy from an international lawyer perspective. That's actually quite difficult. International lawyers would like to see new treaties. In the environment we're in internationally today versus that of the 60s, it's unlikely we're going to see new space treaties. So the fact is technology is moving fast. And because it's moving fast, we're going to have to do something. And I think these treaties are sufficiently worded so that the nations can engage in some of the activities that we've been talking about. The Asteroids Act, of course, was rewritten. There are some slightly different words. I think it's better than it was at first. It was there was a bill passed by the House this year. It's, as we talk, in a conference committee with a Senate version that doesn't have any of the amendment to the House bills that included the Property Rights and Asteroids Act part of it. We'll wait and see what comes out of the conference committee. I think it's clear that private individuals cannot do activities such as selling an acre of land on the moon and things of that sort, according to current international law, because, again, going back to what I said about Article 6 and continuing supervision of a government, governments following the treaties would not allow that. But when we're talking about eventual use of resources in space, the treaties do allow for the exploration and use of space. And I think included in that word use is private as well as government use of resources. And I think it will be possible. If we're going to explore and learn anything about space, we're going to have to. The rovers on Mars are digging and looking at trying to see what's there. So that's been a permissible scientific activity by governments. And how we expand that, if there is a true commercial interest in resources, as we learn more about what's up there, it's going to be an issue of great debate. But I think eventually will be possible.
It's really interesting to me. Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say, and then I'll let you chime in, Sarah, that it's certainly important that we figure out means of making these kinds of decisions, because ultimately we got to get out of here, right? We can't stay. The Earth has an expiration date. So, I'd hate to see us get bogged down in quibbling about how decisions are made to the point where we lose sight of that fact. Go ahead, Sarah.
I was just saying it's just occurring to me how, everything in space is another form of commons. But it sounds like without, we don't have all the rules kind of set out for how the commons is going to operate with humans. But it's just kind of interesting to think about it as this like unencumbered commons out there that we have to figure out how we can all share it. I wondered if either of you, I don't know which of you wants to take this, but just for me, kind of hearing all these, the articles and the treaties, it's kind of hard to make it concrete in my head. So if you, and I guess I'm just going to assume that maybe that's the case for other people listening. Could you talk a little bit about maybe some hypotheticals of, potentially, realistic situations that kind of get to some of those gray areas that could turn into disputes but maybe never have risen to the level of a formal dispute, but just kind of like the edge cases, and just walk us through it a little bit.
And if you need a specific example, we already mentioned one on the show, Professor Hertzfeld did, the problem of something happening in that zone that we're not quite sure is outer space or aerospace.
Well, yeah, I mean, if something happens, it will be specific to that incident, just like any, let's say, accident that occurs. an aircraft is involved in an accident, and we investigate, and then we try to make sure that that particular thing doesn't happen again. Something else can happen. We're dealing with a very complex set of equipment, as well as an environment in space that we understand a lot better than we used to, but we don't fully understand it. So that, things do happen, things will happen. And at that point, you deal with them as you would any accident. You investigate and then figure out a resolution. That sort of common sense and isn't really that much of a treaty issue.
I guess I was thinking more along the choice of law questions, if there are ever gray areas there where it actually might be complicated to figure out which law applies.
Then there are some rules about accidents, if that's what you want to talk about. If anything, first of all, in the liability convention, if anything falls down to earth that was part of a vehicle or a satellite that's up there, the launching state is absolutely liable for whatever damage on Earth may have occurred. And which means that if a claim is – if a rocket, the U.S. rocket lands on a anywhere in the world that and does some damage that we have to make the other nation whole and fix the property, pay for the injuries or deaths, whatever. And if a Russian vehicle accidentally lands in the United States, similarly, you'd have to pay. There's one incident that space lawyers refer to, and that was a Russian satellite with a nuclear reactor on it back in the 70s came in and landed on some unfortunately uninhabited Canadian territory. In Canada, filed a claim with Russia, and in the end, Russia paid paid Canada some money for that cleanup, the Cosmos 954 incident. So there is some precedent. When back in 2009, the United States had launched a satellite, it was a defense satellite, US 193, and it didn't get to orbit. It was tumbling in that gray area, and it was going to re-enter the Earth. It had hydrazine on it, big tank of hydrazine, which is a very potent chemical. If it landed in a populated area, it would be severe and could and a very serious accident. So there was a decision made to try to shoot it down and in a safe place. And we did that in the Pacific Ocean. It landed in the ocean and no damages were done. But once that decision was made, our State Department representatives went to every country's embassy where there might have been a possibility that it would it could land if it did on Earth on land rather than on the sea, and basically reiterated what I said, that the United States would take responsibility and would fix whatever damage was done. Probabilities, though, of serious damage are pretty low. When you think about the tragic Columbia accident where the shuttle broke up on reentry and, it flew and the parts landed over Texas and Louisiana, and we were very lucky. No, there was no serious damage done because it was a relatively sparsely populated area, and nobody was killed or injured as a result of that accident. So, and 3/4 of the Earth is water, so that the odds are with us, but that doesn't mean we couldn't have some major damage on Earth. But that's taken care of in the treaties. The interesting issue as we move ahead is what happens if there's an accident in orbit. And according to the treaties, it's fault liability. In other words, which nation caused that accident? Was there negligence? And we don't have a definition in the treaties of negligence or fault. You know, do we use U.S. Law in that? And then where, what state, if we used U.S. law? Or, if we had civil law involved, all these things would have to be resolved somehow, and to try to find the joint or severable liability of the nation that might have been at fault in an accident of that sort. So that's where we're going to have to do some real thinking. And once an incident occurred, the facts of evidence from that incident would probably be the determining factor in some way of how we would deal with that internationally. Once again, we've had accidents in space. Things have hit each other, as you know, Iridium Cosmos a few years back and other things. But we have yet to have an accident in space where there was significant economic damage, significant enough to warrant a lawsuit. That has not happened yet.
Is that just a matter of time, though, Professor Hertzfeld, with all of the flotsam and jetsam that is orbiting around up there? And you mentioned the little CubeSats that are inexpensive and hard to see, and yet I would assume could do a lot of damage, since space orbiting materials aren't made to be very sturdy or collision resistant. How do we deal with fender benders and worse among orbital devices?
Yeah. Well, we have some guidelines for this that are fairly vague, but at least there are guidelines to help prevent an increase in debris. Many of the bigger, anyway, new satellites are maneuverable and perhaps can be maneuvered to avoid an accident. Those little CubeSats, the technology is still being developed, and maybe they'll be maneuverable at some point. Most of them are in very low Earth orbit and will fall back and burn up and not be any serious threat. But even though space is a big place, it is getting more crowded, and someday something will happen. But trying to predict whether it will be tomorrow or 20 years from now is really an impossible thing to do. So that all we can do is work on it. We're developing better systems for space surveillance and conjunction analysis, meaning trying to predict if and when something will collide. But this is a growing problem, probably not a near-term one, but in certain orbits, that it will be a something we're going to have to deal with. And the other thing to keep in mind is that these small sats are fairly cheap, and there are a lot of them up there. Will there be enough economic damage, or will they explode into lots of different parts, and all those parts will multiply as what's known in the industry as the Kessler syndrome, and then there'll be even more chances of an accident? Again, not yet, but all these scenarios are out there, and we haven't adequately dealt with them yet.
Nathan, how will we deal with them?
Sorry, I was engaged in some discussion on the IRC chat talking about the possibility of salvage in space. Mm-hmm. So I was not actually paying attention to what you guys were talking about.
So we're talking about items in geosynchronous orbit or other orbits that are either operating autonomously or operating with a crew. And the fact that there's a lot of them up there, and although we haven't really had a fender bender problem yet, that's certainly a possibility. And it seems as though the laws and treaties that we have in place now aren't really equipped to handle, you know, if someone's CubeSat, suppose it's a school. That's I've read a lot about schools wanting to send up their own CubeSat to do various academic kinds of curriculum oriented stuff. Your little CubeSat clocks into an actual manned space station. I know, you know, there will be guidelines for who can occupy what orbit, but technology being what it is, things can go awry and go places where they're not supposed to be. And how do you think we'll handle all that?
I want to go back to, I think, one thing you said. You know, the larger objects that are put into space, there's a lot of money invested in them, and they are made to be somewhat durable. Because aside from space debris, there's also sort of natural meteorites in space. So a lot of these larger objects, including the International Space Station, are meant to be, again, somewhat durable. And Bigelow Aerospace, their inflatable space habitat concept, as scary as it sounds to be inside an inflatable bubble in space, that's actually supposed to be even more durable because a lot of those small items like meteorites are supposed to be able to sort of bounce off of it almost. But I think, again, if you want a current boogeyman, these CubeSats, CubeSats from smaller organizations like universities, you know, they may not be themselves made to be too durable. Like you said, they can be harder to see, harder to track. The more objects you have in space, the harder it is maybe to keep tabs on it all. And we can talk about some of the organizations out there, including the Air Force, that do almost a public international service of trying to keep track of things in outer space and warn operators about that. But what comes to my mind immediately is there was a study or a headline I saw. I can't remember if it said 2/5 of CubeSats or 3/5 of CubeSats actually aren't compliant with end-of-use regulations. So these CubeSats, satellites are supposed to reserve fuel to take themselves into graveyard orbit, i.e. get out of the way once their lifetime is over. But if these CubeSats aren't compliant, then all of a sudden you could have, again, these smaller operators that are just sort of leaving their satellites in desirable orbits, and that could lead to problems down the line.
All right. Well, I think you've given us our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law, and it's going to be clocked by a cube. Jot those down if you are listening to the show for continuing legal or other professional education credit. And if you need more information about that, head on over to wiki.twit.tv. Find our This Week in Law show page there. And we've got a whole 50-state breakdown, at least for the lawyers in the audience who might be seeking to use their time listening to the show and enjoying the really fascinating guests that we have on to further their legal educational goals. We are here with two very fascinating guests, Henry Hertzfeld and Nathan Johnson, talking about space law today. We're going to get to some more really interesting topics such as space elevators, what China is up to in space these days, and funding or the lack thereof for ongoing space exploration, as well as, of course, Star Wars. How could we not talk about military and security things going on in space as well? So we are going to get to that after we thank our second sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, and that is FreshBooks. If you're a freelancer or you run a small business, chances are your least favorite part is rummaging through receipts, trying to keep track of your expenses, creating, formatting, and sending invoices, and the worst, tracking down customers who don't want to pay you on time. FreshBooks is the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of businesses like yours the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. And let me tell you, I have been a drinker of the FreshBooks Kool-Aid for some time now. It is actually the accounting end of my law practice. And I'm so glad that it is, because it just makes that whole process of tracking time, tracking expenses, billing clients, and getting paid something that I don't have to give much thought at all. It just works seamlessly and professionally and well. And that's what you want from your accounting solution for your business. You'll be creating and sending invoices in minutes. You can organize your expenses easily. It's easy to track your time almost instantly, even on mobile devices. And with their automated late payment reminders, you can avoid those awkward emails or phone calls to your clients saying, I haven't gotten my check. You'll wonder why you didn't start sooner. If you have questions, help is free forever, and you can always count on FreshBooks award-winning support rock stars to go above and beyond whenever you need a hand. Getting started is simple, and it's totally free for 30 days. Go to freshbooks.com/twill, and don't forget to enter This Week in Law in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today. Thank you so much, FreshBooks, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, let's talk space elevators for a moment. Lockheed Martin is attempting to develop one. There is a business in Canada that was in the news recently. What do you think about space elevators and the legal ramifications of them, Professor Hertzfeld?
Nathan talked about the moot court teams a little while ago, and he didn't mention it, but he was actually on the GW team a couple of years ago. But the I guess it was about 10 years ago now, in 2005, there was a question. Space elevators were a hot topic then. And there was one of these international moot court questions based on the space elevator and the chain that would go to space got broken and fell back into the ocean and did some damage and things of that sort. So there's been some thought on this, of course, over time. Nothing happened 10 years ago because, of course, the technology was too new, and there are a lot of issues. If you have a big tether going hundreds of miles over 100 miles up into space and being held up there. But let's get down back to basics. And anything like that would be quite a ways off before it was built, tested, and verified, and it was safe, and all the rest. The elevators themselves, though, are just another indication of the end of what is almost the holy grail in the space engineering area, and that is trying to find a cheap way, cheap access to space. We haven't found it yet. All the launch vehicles, the chemical propulsion is very expensive. It's true that CubeSats can be launched fairly cheaply. It's only because they're very light in weight and very small and not really as capable as many of the big satellites. It's not because we've made any breakthroughs in launch in launch technologies. So there have been other proposals for cheap access to space, and they haven't gone very far. So that I wouldn't rule out anything, but I would just say that if companies are experimenting with this, that's great. And it's going to be quite a while before we would see anything that we'd have to deal with from a legal perspective. And I don't think that a space elevator really opens up any new ground in space law. I mean, it's still a launch vehicle of sorts, and you would have many of the same issues, safety, liability, reliability, all those things that we have today.
In IRC, I have to just let you all know that someone brought up facetiously, but yet hearkening back to our earlier part of the show and discussing IP issues, the issue of the music on the space elevator. How is it going to be licensed? We don't know. Nathan, anything to add to space elevator tech or law, particularly given your moot court experience?
Yeah, you know, the way we would approach it in moot court, you look at the actual technology that the question's about. A space elevator would pass through your national airspace and then ideally would get to outer space. So as far as, you know, licensing in your national airspace, you would have to definitely talk to regular FAA about that, just to make sure you don't establish the space elevator right in the middle of a very busy plane route. And then in outer space, you'd have to make sure you have, you know, the slot designation for the other end of your space elevator, and that, again, your space elevator doesn't happen to cross through somebody else's very important orbit. But to tie it into the music issue, again, we don't have a single definition for where outer space begins. So, you know, would you be able to play the same music during the entire elevator ride? Or for safety's sake, would you have to stop playing the music once you reach a certain height because your U.S. license to play that is over? And you'd have to, you know, listen to the sounds of silence for the rest of the trip up to the satellite end.
Only if so, it wasn't the Simon and Garfunkel version.
Yeah, those guys are litigious. So, you know, the space elevator, again, like Professor Hertzfeld said, it's a hypothetical concept right now, but you have people who are drawing that up, who are thinking about it, and who are, you know, providing fodder for moot court competitions to think about. Yes. And, you know, another technology to think about is solar-based power, the idea of using solar rays in orbit to take the sun's rays without having it to dilute through the Earth's atmosphere, collecting that in orbit, and then using microwave power to send it down to the surface of the Earth. You're not just going to blanket the surface of the Earth with highly energized microwaves. You'd send it down to a receiver station, but again, you'd have to think about the path that that's going to take. You don't want to accidentally fry any planes that are flying through the path of your microwaves. And then the same sort of liability issues. What happens if the satellite gets knocked a little bit off course and you're no longer sending microwaves down to a receiver dish, you're sending microwaves down to a small town. Same thing with the space elevator. If, you know, God forbid, something snaps and that, you know, 100 kilometer, 100 mile cable suddenly falls back down on the Earth, you know, it'll be like a scene from the 2009 Star Trek movie when that, you know, mining ship sort of snaps and falls into the San Francisco Bay.
Yes.
You have those very real physical aspects. You know, I'll just say if there's a business involved that's investing money, nobody wants to put up, you know, a half-designed structure. If they put something up in space, they're going to want it to be as durable as possible.
You're going to have to be a really go-getter insurance company to want to insure those kinds of businesses too. Sarah, any thoughts on this?
No, I actually have to drop from I have a conference call at 3. But
that's right. It is 1 o'clock. I'm glad I cut to you and remembered that. We are so glad that you could join us today. Sarah, of course, is senior counsel with Creative Commons and love chatting with her every week here on This Week in Law. Sarah, anything you need to let us know before you're out of here?
No, the only thing I wanted to ask was just like a total high level question is how many of you are there? How many space lawyers out there are there? Is there like a bar association of this? I mean, it had never occurred to me.
There
but
is
it makes
most definitely
sense.
A bar. I just don't know if it's a bar association.
No, there is an organization called the International Institute of Space Law, and I think the membership is somewhere around a couple of hundred people.
In the whole world?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Interesting.
It's international.
Yes.
And who are your clients? And generally, the clients are governments, right? Is it mainly not private practice?
It's everything. And I mean, if you really want to include the lawyers who do telecommunications law, file applications to the FCC here, similar things in other nations. You wouldn't call them space lawyers so much. They're not dealing directly with the treaties and some of the things right. We've been talking about today. But there are many more than a couple of hundred if we're dealing with the applications of space. That's the geospatial, remote sensing, Earth observations people, and export control issues. You can go on and on. So that just the numbers that I quoted are those who are interested enough to join an organization, not necessarily all those dealing with space issues nationally and internationally. And they're both private lawyers and government lawyers.
Gotcha. All right. Well, it was fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah. We'll see you next week.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Where should we go from here? Go ahead, Henry.
I just wanted to add something to the space elevator discussion.
Yeah, please.
Pardon me. And that is that at least the original proposal was to launch from the ocean, from the middle of the Pacific Ocean, not from a nation. And even there, we have some precedent. There was a company called Sea Launch, which built a platform. It was a platform, I think, was built by the Norwegians, the rocket by the Ukrainians, the engines by the Russians, and it was managed by Boeing, the United States Corporation. But even Sea Launch could not launch from the middle of the ocean without a license. And eventually, because Boeing had the biggest share, the United States was the licensing and the state of registry for the Sea Launch operation. It's now gone bankrupt. It's not in business. But even launching from the middle of the ocean does not solve a company's legal issues with licensing and national jurisdiction over the facility.
Well, that seems like a good segue into talking about other countries besides the United States and Russia. Exploring space, putting things in orbit, etc. And of course, China is a huge global superpower and definitely has designs on doing more in space. Journalists who want to publish articles on the topic tend to use sensational headlines. We have one in our rundown today. World war brews in space between China, U.S. and Russia. Can the two of you fill us in on what China is doing in space and whether that headline is warranted or not, or whether there are concerns along the lines of the ownership and policy and decision-making considerations we've been talking about so far, or even on a military level. Can we start with you, Nathan?
Yeah. Like you said, there is a easily sensationalized aspect to all of this. There's some people who are looking for a boogeyman, who are always looking for some militaristic conflict to spur the space industry. And, they would say something like, if China plans to visit the moon, would China decide to withdraw from the Outer Space Treaty and suddenly claim the moon as their property? So they use that to spur on the U.S. to be like, no, we have to return to the moon as soon as possible and defend our claim to at least share it. I think that's highly sensationalized. What we see from China, at least from what I remember at presentations, was that China is very good at establishing five-year goals to advance their industry and their capabilities. They have taconauts, astronauts. They have manned space flight. They have built and designed a modular space station. I believe they have connected at least two modules. I don't know. I can't remember if they have actually put taconauts on the space station yet. But again, for a country that has sort of centralized control, to say it as politely as possible, they set five-year goals for their development, and they meet those five-year goals. And that can be very intimidating to powers like the U.S. and Russia, who sort of become complacent with their role as space leaders. Within the U.S., we have a lot of discussion about where is our space program going, where is our next generation vehicle. And in Russia, in the past couple of years, they've had some major restructuring. Even though they had gone you know, in established private companies that could do space exploration. We've seen the government consolidating those companies and taking, again, a government stake in space companies in Russia there. And they have ambitions to also reestablish themselves in space. So you have the same sort of geopolitical geopolitical struggles between the countries trying to maintain a balance or trying to maintain their leading role in certain aspects, which leads to that sensationalization. But again, we also have similar capabilities. So the U.S. Proved that they could modify a sea-to-air missile to shoot down a very low tumbling satellite. Russia has a secretive space object that can maneuver between different orbits. China tested an ASAT anti-satellite capability. Everybody is moving around and sort of displaying, as you would, your capabilities out there. But again, ideally, we all want to keep the peace. And so nobody has made aggressive moves against each other. So we have that dual aspect that has been with the space race all along. It right. is, it was developed with a lot of military backing, but the public face of it is peaceful uses. And it's a great thing when we can have cooperation, like we had the joint Apollo-Soyuz demonstrations between the U.S. and Russia even before the wall fell. And that's one of the discussions we have now is the U.S. and Russia are two of the parties in the International Space Station. Would we ever invite the Chinese to participate in that? And mm-hmm. there we get into some domestic politics. There are some members in the U.S. Congress who are vehemently against any cooperation, especially space cooperation with China. And I believe Professor Hertzfeldt might be able to speak more to those specific examples.
Yes, please, Professor Hertzfeldt. Are we about to bring, are Russia and the U.S. about to bring China into the space exploration fold?
They're there. We don't have to bring them in.
Yeah.
And they have sent Taikonauts up to the their space station. Let me try, this is an interesting and difficult question. We don't even know a lot about what their real plans are. We can see different things happening. I was fortunate last November I attended a UN conference that China hosted on space law, and about 200 Chinese people were there and invited some outside, some international lawyers, and it was run by UN COPUS. And it was really a show that ostensibly they wanted, the Chinese, to learn more about international law and laws of other nations. Quite honestly, I think they know an awful lot about all the laws of other nations, at least from the Chinese lawyers I've spoken with. And I've been there twice and even lectured at universities there. They're not ignorant of that. But I think they also wanted to show their government and that about the importance of international law. China has ratified the space treaties. They did a long time ago. And the issue, I think, is in their domestic environment of what the lawyers who are easy to talk to and you can agree with, and they agree with you about these principles, versus the politics and what's going on with the PLA and other things that we don't see in China. And, I think what Nathan said about attitudes in the U.S., in our Congress anyway, about cooperating with China, it's a serious problem. I'm not so sure that China is as open as we might like to cooperate in areas that might be considered relatively sensitive. And I think those will remain fairly shut for quite a while. And superimposed on top of it, of course, are all the human rights and other issues that are not space related, but international politics with China. But I do believe that there are many people in China who would like to see cooperation. I do not believe that they want a war with the United States. I wouldn't go that far, and I wouldn't. I think these newspaper headlines can be very misleading. But are they doing a lot in space? Are they preparing for their own defense, just as we are? Sure. Exactly what, I don't know. And, you know, I don't even want to guess. So that, you know, I don't think that we're in a new space race the way we had it with the Soviet Union to show off technology to the rest of the world. I think it's a very different environment today. China has entered into relationships with many different nations, and parenthetically, I think a number of them are resource-oriented, you know, Venezuela and Nigeria and others. They will launch satellites for them and use space as part of a trade means of getting more oil, for example, which they don't have as much of. So mm-hmm. that, you know, we're in an interesting international environment that where space is just one of the elements of all of the areas of trade, cooperation, and resource allocation in the world. So I think we have to be cognizant of what they do. We have to be prepared. But I don't see a war with either Russia or China in the near term. Some competition for sure, but and again, I think China is probably more focused on the Asia Pacific Rim in terms mm-hmm. of what it's planning and what it's doing than the United States directly.
Well, whether lawmakers are taking the more short-term kind of view of, well, we've got to keep our technologies and exploration and capabilities current with what others around the globe are doing, or whether they're looking more long-term, and getting back to the point I made earlier that, you know, our time on this rock is limited, one thing that lawmakers here in the U.S. and elsewhere control is how much money gets allocated to space-related research and exploration. Nathan, you pointed me toward a New York Times op-ed from earlier this week by David, what is his last name? David Brown, who's writing a book about the scientists who build a spacecraft to explore the outer planets. Anything you want to let us know? The interesting factoid from the op-ed is that NASA's budget in the U.S. is less than one half of 1% of the federal budget. Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to bring up this op-ed because since starting law school, my view of space law has always been very broad. And it's not just about the hypotheticals of, you know, what's going to happen when two people meet in orbit, but what affects the industries behind space development. And one of those things is government appropriations and funding. And, you know, this article points out the NASA budget, you know, going from year to year is also subject to, you know, Congress not passing a budget every year and sometimes going to continuing resolutions or sometimes shutting down for a while. The article specifically talks about Congress shutting down and by law, NASA not being allowed to spend money on a satellite that really had a very narrow window for launching to achieve its mission. So we have those sorts of aspects on individual missions of planetary science. We also have longer-term aspects like funding for the new commercial crew program versus funding for the NASA Orion module and funding for the space launch system. And on the outside, you know, you have people who are watching this and they may criticize Congress and say, why don't you fully fund commercial crew so that we can launch astronauts on American rockets from American soil sooner while you are paying for seats on the Russian Soyuz instead? And I should also mention that I interned with the House Science Committee, and my what I say here does not represent them. I think on the other side, you have lawmakers who see themselves spending tax dollars on behalf of the public and them saying that, commercial crew looks great. It's still some unproven rockets and technology. They have serious safety concerns. They're talking to their legacy contractors, and they'd rather, portion money and develop the Space Launch System and the Orion module long-term rather than, immediately put up money for SpaceX to start flying astronauts. So you have really a lot of competing interests and competing visions for the near-term future for how space development will go in the U.S. And then you have some other intricacies like a defense language that says that the Air Force can't spend money on rockets that use refurbished Russian engines. Well, then all of a sudden you have an Air Force portfolio that can't launch in the foreseeable future because their primary launch vehicle depends on Russian refurbished engines. And that upsets things as well. So I like to point out how much of an impact congressional appropriation and funding has on space development in the U.S. short-term and long-term.
Professor Hertzfeld, with the budget, with NASA's budget currently being less than 0.5% of the federal budget, does that just mean that we are shifting away from government-funded space exploration and work and toward a future of the private sector driving this, or does it not mean that?
Absolutely not. NASA's budget's roughly $18 billion a year. That's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. The United States spends roughly $40 billion a year in space, which is more than half of the world's expenditures. No other nation spends that much in space. We really don't know how much China spends. But of all the nations, what we do know, we're the elephant in the game, and there's no question about it. What we're talking about, what Nathan was talking about, is primarily how we spend it, the distribution. And that is up for grabs, and obviously there are companies involved, there are politics involved, there are new technologies, and we argue about this publicly all the time in Congress and the executive branch. I think that Nathan sort of touched on one of the major problems with our system, and it's not NASA, it's the annual appropriations, where we, unlike many other countries, cannot plan long-term because we don't know for sure how the money is going to be allocated next year. I'd like to point out that since the 1990s, we've had a whole host of acronyms and different launch vehicle development programs. We've spent over $20 billion, 25 probably, on these programs, and every one of them has been canceled for one reason or another. Some technology, some politics, our democracy is never not that efficient all the time. maybe that's an understatement. So I think we have the ability still, and we still have some of the most sophisticated technology. We're the leader in space. The pie is growing. There are many more nations building launch vehicles. They want independent access to space, and also space have space capabilities than in the past. That's growing, so that our share of the world's pie, the world's expenditures in space, has shrunk a bit. But in absolute dollars, we've been very level. And even in a serious budget situation and and deficit situation, Congress has given NASA at least level funding, which in today's world is somewhat of a victory. We're not back in the Apollo era where we had for a few years, a very huge surge in expenditures. For a long time, it's been a fraction of the U.S. budget, a very small fraction of the U.S. budget. And it's probably going to remain that way when we have problems of, as you know, health and housing and, you know, and food distribution and everything else. Getting more money allocated to space is going to be, is probably not going to happen unless there is a very, very specific need for it in a very sensitive area of some sort. So,
well, that's a fantastic segue to something I wanted to ask you about before we go ahead and wrap the show, ask you both about, because I, through all of the pieces that I read and getting ready for this show, and pretty much in IRC, as we've been chatting throughout the show, the topic that keeps coming up that we haven't talked about yet is water, how there is water in space and a need not only for water to fuel space-oriented activities, that, that water is a necessary resource if you're going to build things in space and fuel them in space. But I live in California, and we are suffering. So if you could briefly speak to the subject of water, and maybe it does jibe with our funding conversation here. Professor Hertzfeld, could that be a very specific instance where we see more budget allocated to outer space research?
I don't think so. First of all, we're not bringing any water back from space. How much is up there? How much is usable? We still don't know. And the whole idea of water being valuable in space is so that we don't have to transport it from Earth to space. And water plus methane, you can make rocket fuel out of it up there. So if we want to go deeper in space, do more, we could basically create a fueling depot of some sort using resources from space. Keep in mind also, unlike Earth, where we do have a water cycle and usually renews itself. I know California is right now in a serious way, and we have other places in the world too. But it's not something we want to bring back. We're going to bring back from space. That's out of the question. It would be for use in space on space missions at the present time. And
right.
And the only other minor reason that I might think of for space contributions to this situation is better use of Earth resources observations and tracking and trending and managing water distribution in this country that and elsewhere. There we can do better with predictions and better observations and perhaps help with conservation efforts through using some of the – making what we do now in those efforts more efficient, more productive, and better using space capabilities. But that alone is not a reason to go to space. It is a side benefit from going up there.
Gotcha. Nathan, any water thoughts before we give our audience our tip and resource?
You know, I'm not going to disagree with an economist when he says that trying to bring water from space down to Earth is inefficient use. But, you know, when we talk about hypotheticals and you want to dream big, the idea of creating fuel depots in space, if you had a sophisticated enough robotic mission to go to an asteroid or go to another planet, and before you ever arrive with a crew-carrying spaceship, you had a little factory that started taking the water, turning it into usable fuel, so that by the time, you know, your crew of three people on a Dragon version, whatever, finally reaches Mars, they know that they will have enough fuel for their return flight. Or once you start talking about not just returning to Earth, but going further, have little fuel depots set up along the way. That is really, really hypothetical. But that is sort of one of the dreams of use of water in space. So if it doesn't make you thirsty in Southern California to think of using water just as fuel, and that's, you know, one of the goals in a generation or so to try to do.
Everything makes me thirsty in Southern California these days. Thank you for that, Nathan. Well, one thing you can do with water in space, as learned by a distillery in Scotland and now also on board the International Space Station, at least for 3 years while it was aging some whiskey up there, is you can make whiskey with water in space. Interesting story over at Ars Technica chronicling Aardberg's experience distilling, maturing, and aging whiskey in space to see if it made a difference. And I realize there's not much of a legal tie-in with this story, but it very much ties into bars. So we'll just go ahead and go with that.
I will say that lawyers drink whiskey, so that makes it.
Exactly. I don't know that the experiment might have gone as well as Aardberg wished. From the article, testers described the whiskey aged in space as tasting definitely different than the same whiskey they did, you know, a test batch on the ISS and the same batch here on Earth. And there were definite differences. The space whiskey was described as intense and rounded with notes of antiseptic smoke, rubber, smoked fish, and a curious perfumed note like cassis or violet. Well, that could be good. And woody tones leading to a beefy aroma. The taste was different too, with it being described as very focused and an aftertaste that was intense and long with hints of wood, antiseptic lozenges, and rubbery smoke. I don't know that I necessarily need to do much more research into whiskey in space. I'm not real sold on it based on the batch that came back from Aardberg and the response of its taste testers, but just wanted to share that tip with you that that people are distilling and aging whiskey in space. All right, and then our resource of the week comes to you courtesy of my son, who decided the other day that he would like to name a star. And I started to do some research into star naming and learned from the International Astronomical Union that all of the various outfits out there that purport to have you name a star are very unofficial and simply there to collect your money. Here's what there's a great resource. This is the resource of the week called The Layman's Guide to Star Naming, published from the International Astronomical Union, that tells you all about star naming and their stance on it. And the fact that really no matter how much money you pay to people, what you're getting is a pretty piece of paper and a warm feeling and not an official name of a star. Here's what they have to say in their pretend Q&A on the topic. They hypothesize someone asking, surely the courts will recognize the name I have paid for. And they answer, try to contact your lawyers. Chances are they will either laugh their heads off or politely suggest that you could invest their fees more productively. And then again, but what about the companies that sell pieces of territory on the moon and other planets? Those are within reach. We know. So surely I can have the piece that I bought. And again, they say, see the answer to the previous question. As a minimum, we suggest that you defer payment until you can take possession of your property. I will give you one further resource aside from the guide that debunks the whole notion of star naming as any kind of official activity. And that is the fact there is an observatory, the Sydney Observatory, that has been maintaining its own Sydney Southern Star Catalog since 1983. And it, too, will allow you to pay to name a star in their star catalog. And information is available at the Sydney Observatory website. And the difference here is it's not just someone taking your money. This is an official tax deductible donation. It's run by astronomers. The income goes towards the observatory's collection, heritage, and programs. And to boot, if you really want to do this and name a star, and if you happen to be in Sydney, Australia, they give you the opportunity to spend a night viewing your star, the star you've named, through their telescopes with one of their astronomers and up to four other people. So that sounds like a pretty good deal if you're going to go name a star. Professor Hertzfeld, any thoughts or insights on our tip or resource or anything else we've discussed today before we go ahead and wrap the show?
Not too much. It's Just a comment about the private companies and trying to make a little money from the public on it. Your description was, of course, quite accurate. There is one case called Nemitz v. the United States, Ninth Circuit, and this man, Mr. Nemitz, had registered with some international unofficial registry that he owned the asteroid Eros. NASA had landed a probe on Eros. He wrote a letter to NASA and asked for a parking fee of $20. And, of course, it was never paid. And he took it to court. And it was dismissed. And one of the basis for that dismissal was a very strong letter from the State Department, or the U.S. State Department, that reaffirmed the fact that there's no sovereignty on space and that he was not the rightful owner of that asteroid.
That's good to know. Nathan, anything further you want to add?
I just want to mention, there was the question, how many space lawyers are there? And for any U.S. attorneys that are watching, the American Bar Association actually has three different groups that talk about space law. There's the Space Law Committee within the Science and Technology Division, of which I am a co-vice chair. There's also the Forum on Air and Space Law. And the Torts and Trial Insurance Practice Section actually has an aviation and space law group as well. So there are many attorneys, including in the U.S., who practice or like to talk about space law in one way or another.
That's great to know. You know, I'm old enough to remember when internet law was not a common thing that people practiced or studied. And there were just a few hundred in the U.S. who were even paying attention to issues around the then quite nascent internet and online communications in general. So my hat is off to the two of you pioneers for being among the first in your field, and to Professor Hertzfeld in particular, who's been teaching on this topic for more than a decade. Yes. And really, you guys are, you're charting our future as we speak. So we appreciate your work on that. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate your being on the show today. We have a long show. We go deep on a lot of topics, and I've been thrilled to be able to do that today. I'll mention, too, that I was inspired to put together this show and do it by reading Neal Stephenson's book, Seven Eves, that came out over the summer, which raises tons of the kinds of issues that we've been discussing here today. So if you just can't get enough of it and want to dive in more and really explode your head, go and read all 850 pages of that book, because it's a great read. Anything, Professor Hertzfeld, going on at George Washington University or in your program that you want to leave people with knowledge of before we go ahead and sign off?
Well, actually, just to mention, not only do we have a course in the law school, and we actively support the moot court competitions we talked about before. We've had I've coached a team now for the last 11 years, and in the process of forming one this year. But I also have an appointment at the School of International Affairs, and we have a Space Policy Institute. We have a website, and we publish and hold a number of conferences and on all sorts of issues on space and international space. And, I encourage anybody who's interested to get in touch and to even think about the master's program here in the Elliott School in International Science and Technology Policy, and we have a specialty in space policy as well. Thanks.
That's excellent. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget to subscribe to Nathan's excellent space law newsletter, Astro Esquire. Anything else we can plug? There's also a Twitter account for that I believe you're seeing if you're watching the video. Anything else, Nathan, you want to let people know about before we say goodbye?
I've mentioned the ABA Space Law Committee, the International Institute of Space Law. If there's anybody who is currently at a law school or maintains contacts with their law school, and they want their school to have the opportunity to compete in the space law moot court competition, you know, sign up for my newsletter, message me on Twitter, and we'd love to get more schools involved in the competition. And for myself, one of my goals is to grow the network of space law students and young professionals. So, you know, I'd like to be able to one day more definitively answer the question, how many space lawyers are there? So again, if there's anybody who wants to become part of that network and grow with it, sign up for my newsletter. I'll list events and organizations that they can join, and I'll be trying to put people in touch.
Well, and I'm sure before too long, the answer to that question will be too many to count. So we're glad to have had you here when we could still perhaps count the number, and really enjoyed going through all of the various lofty topics that we've covered today. Folks, we've been thrilled that you've been able to join us. If you've done so at starting around, we got a little bit of a late start today, 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC, then you've been able to join us live. That's when we record the show every week. If you haven't, don't worry about that. And don't worry if you can't join us live. It's great. If you can, you can jump in IRC and interact with us during the show. But if you're, you know, someone who needs to watch TWIL on your own time, then head over to twit.tv/TWIL. Our archive of shows is there waiting for you to be consumed however you would like. So don't forget about that. Tell your friends and tell us what you'd like to, you know, if you would like us to do more specialty topic shows like this, we would love to hear from you about that. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Sarah is Sarah P at twit.tv. And you can get in touch with us on Twitter, on I keep wanting to say on Instagram. We do not have an Instagram account for This Week in Law. Maybe we should start one. We do have Facebook, Google Plus, and Twitter accounts for the show, though. And any of those are great ways to also get in touch and continue the conversation after the show. Let us know what you thought. Let us know who you think we should have on the show, what you'd like to see us discuss. We love hearing from you. And we look forward to seeing you, hopefully, next week on This Week in Law. Take care.